Take RFM Dunedin with you wherever you go, with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This programme was first broadcast on RFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, resilience on radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher, who's not here tonight, and me, Samuel Mann, who is here tonight, and I'm in Glasgow at CHAI, the Conference on Human-Computer Interaction, which they twist the words around and call it CHAI instead of HCI. And at that conference, there's a whole lot of people who are developing new technology, and there's a whole pile of people who are looking at that new technology and saying, are we sure that's the right thing? How are we doing with managing that process? And one of those people is Dr. Helena Webb from the Department of Computer Science at the University of Oxford. She's a senior researcher there. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in the southeast of England in a town called Guildford, which is about an hour away from London.
What was it like there?
It's all right. It's kind of a commuter town, so a lot of people who live there, you know, work in London, so it's not necessarily the most lively of places, but it was a very safe place to grow up, very good schools, so I'm very grateful that I grew up there.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, well, truthfully, I didn't know, and so I told people that I wanted to become a lawyer, because, you know, I always did well at school. I didn't do the kind of like hard science subjects, I did the other kind of subjects, and everybody who was good at school either wanted to become a scientist or a lawyer. So I thought, I can't become like a hard scientist, so I guess I'll have to be a lawyer. So that's what I told people, but I never really had my heart in it.
When did you fess up?
When I was at university, I guess. So originally I was thinking I would do law at university, but then I kind of thought, no, maybe I don't want to do that. And I was looking around for a subject to take at university. I wanted to do something new that I hadn't done before. So then I learned about the social sciences. So I ended up doing an undergraduate degree in social and political sciences. So that was sociology, politics, social psychology, and social anthropology. And my initial plan was I'll do that for undergraduate, and then I'll do a law conversion course afterwards, and I'll become a lawyer. And then I learned through my friends who are studying law that it's a great career, but the law degree is not very interesting. Actually, you're just learning stuff. Whereas the social science stuff, I really loved it, and I really felt at home studying in that kind of environment. And so it was during my undergraduate degree that I sort of realised that was a direction I wanted to go in.
Can you summarise what you learned?
Oh, good heavens. So many things. A lot of it was about, oh, it's sort of, so in social sciences, you're interested in how the social world works, so sort of patterns you find in it, how people behave in certain situations, how things are organized on a kind of like a small scale level and a high scale level. But I think if one thing you can say about the social sciences, it's about kind of an attitude, it's about a critical thinking about things, it's not taking things for granted, and, you know, it's understanding, well, here's a definition of, you know, law or society or whatever, and but not taking that definition for granted, like unpacking it, like picking into it and trying to figure out what does it really mean, how do people understand it, and so on. So in lots of ways I think the social sciences is kind of an attitude about things.
And to put it into the probably the opposite of what I should do at that point, what did you do with it?
Well, after I finished my degree, I did nothing with it at first, because I came towards the end of my undergraduate and I knew I wanted to go back into postgraduate study, but I didn't know the particular area I wanted to focus on. So I thought I'll go off and do something else for a while, and then I'll come back to it. So in the short term, for about 5 years after my undergraduate, I taught English as a foreign language, which was a fantastic way to see the world. So I spent some time in Japan and then some time in Poland as well, teaching English to teenagers and adults, which was great. And that allowed me some time to think about, you know, what do I want to do? I knew I wanted to study some more, so I went back into university study. I did a master's and then a PhD, and that by that time I knew the areas that I wanted to focus on. So initially my research focused on interaction, so how people communicate with each other. So I've always been very interested in kind of micro level interactions, or how the social world works on a very detailed level, how people between us in the interactions that we do create normality and create what we think as orderliness. So that's the kind of stuff that I studied in my postgraduate.
In practice, that was doctor-patient communication.
Yes, that's right. So I studied doctor-patient communication. Specifically, my PhD looked at weight loss consultations. So I went into consultations where patients had obesity and often other comorbidities. And I actually video recorded the consultations with the patient's knowledge and consent. So I made video recordings of their interactions with doctors as they were talking about weight loss efforts, medications take to help them lose weight. And then I analysed those interactions in detail.
Did you spend 3 years getting ethics approval?
Actually, I spent some time getting ethics approval. But I've always found, because, you know, it's a big undertaking, you know, it's... And consultations are very private things, and very sensibly, you know, universities and hospitals take these things very seriously, the need for approval. But I'm always very impressed and grateful for the ways in which people are open to research, because actually when it came to the point of asking people, you know, can I come into your consultation, video record it, please? They were often very positive about it, because they thought, well, you know, you're doing something and you're trying to find ways to help, you know, improve these services, and we would like to be part of that. So people were surprisingly willing to let me video record their sessions, which I'm very grateful for.
And what did you find?
All kinds of things. I think one of the key things that I really focused on when I was writing up the study was how, you know, obesity is a very particular thing, because it's obviously a medical condition, but then it has all of these other things around it which are far more moral, and a lot of patients, you know, in that clinic, they felt in the outside world they were very kind of stigmatized for their size, and they felt that they were being judged by people all the time. So they would often talk about, you know, not wanting to eat in public because people would stare at them, and they felt they were thinking, why should you be eating, because you're fat, you know, you shouldn't be eating that cake or whatever. So a lot of the work was about sort of how those moral issues sometimes interacted with the more medical issues about how you lose weight, and how the clinical setting was actually an environment where those moral issues were kind of put to one side, and patients were helped to feel like, you know, this is a situation in which you're not being judged. This is a situation in which, you know, we're looking at this weight as a clinical issue, and we're talking about the things that, from the medical side of things, that can be done about it, and the things that you can do about it yourself in terms of exercise and weight loss.
Do doctors get taught how to do that?
Well, I think it varies, and certainly in the UK, there's a lot of emphasis now on teaching doctors communication skills, teaching GPs in particular communication skills, and an awareness that these kinds of moral issues can come into play. I'm not sure how much detail is gone into about these kind of issues, because for these things it's really important to explore the sensitivities around them. So I think there are a lot of efforts at the moment, and certainly a lot of the doctors that I spoke to are very aware of these kind of things, but actually the value of having empirical research behind it is you can show people, you know, oh, if you ask this kind of question you get this kind of answer, whereas if you ask this kind of question you get this kind of answer. And one of the great things about doing kind of detailed interactional work is you can show if you ask this type of question, people get defensive because it kind of implies some kind of blame or responsibility. Whereas if you ask this kind of question, it's much more neutral, and you might find that you can build up a rapport with your patient more easily, or you'll get a longer answer from your patient. So those kind of things, I think, you know, we can do a lot more with doctor training by looking at the detail of consultations.
So you're now at Oxford, but you didn't go straight there.
No, I went to King's College London for about 5 years, where I worked in a research centre called the Work Interaction and Technology Research Centre. And I did similar kinds of work, so similar method. You go into different settings and you make video recordings of what's going on there. So in the work that I did there, I went into a few different settings. So I was part of a couple of projects that looked at eye care. So we went into consultations, you know, at optician services and so on, where people were having eye tests. Because in the WIT group, they're very interested in interaction, but also interactions that involve technology in certain ways. And of course, eye care is, you know, a setting where you have all different kinds of, you know, bits of equipment put in front of you and so on. So we did a lot of work about eye care, including a project with the College of Optometrists in this country to put together training materials for eye care practitioners to help them understand how to communicate with patients. I also did another project which was about surgery, and it was surgical procedures using robots. So there are these robot devices called Da Vinci cradles, which are actually increasingly popular all over the world. And in it, a surgeon doesn't touch the patient directly. The surgeon stands at a console and moves some levers, which move some robotic arms, which move the surgical implement. So it's kind of actually a robot who's cutting open the patient. And this is meant to have all kinds of surgical advantages in terms of improving accuracy, decreasing blood loss and so on, which is why these Da Vinci cradles are so popular. But they completely transform the surgical environment. The surgical procedures rely on cooperation amongst the surgical team, but when you have a Da Vinci setup, it really changes the communication, because the surgeon is sitting away from the rest of the team, often with their back to them, so they can't see what the rest of the team can see, and then it changes the way that they need to communicate with each other. So we did a project that was looking at, you know, how is it that surgical teams can collaborate in those kind of environments using that kind of technology?
Because they wouldn't have that knowing what the person beside them is going to do.
Yes, exactly. They lose, so the surgeon is kind of like sitting in front of like a booth that's a bit like, you know, like an old arcade game. And often they're looking directly at a vision of the surgical field. So they're looking at, you know, a camera that shows the inside of the patient. And they don't have any peripheral vision to see what the rest of the surgical team are doing. So the rest of the team will be standing around the patient. They also have video displays showing the surgical field, but they're on physically different, places. And what happens is, you know, the setup's entirely different, because in often, you know, the surgeon's left is different from the rest of the team's left. So the surgeon can't just say, oh, you know, move the camera to the left, because his or her left will be different from the left of the person. Exactly. So it really changes things at a very fundamental level. And surgeons, you know, when we did the study, we spoke to surgeons, and they would say a lot of the time, you know, when you're controlling a procedure, the kind of peripheral vision is very important, because these teams, they work together for a very long time, and they have like such expert knowledge of each other, and the best surgical teams don't need to talk to each other, because they can kind of anticipate in advance what's needed.
The person's ready to go with
exactly. Exactly, they can see an arm moving, so that they know that an instrument's coming in, or, you know, this person can anticipate the surgeon's going to need that next, and that is all like really vital knowledge and very tacit knowledge that teams have. So they couldn't articulate it, you know, even if they tried, but they have it, and that's the kind of expertise that really makes these situations work. And having the Da Vinci setup there really disrupts that, in particular because the surgeon can't see what the rest of the team is doing. So, you know, someone might start making a gesture, a movement that's the wrong one, and in any other procedure the surgeon will be able to correct it immediately. Whereas if the surgeon's kind of just looking at the Da Vinci cradle, or looking at their monitor, they don't have a chance to correct it.
Do they have
to earlier.
Have somebody else having the oversight?
So they'll have, you'll have one surgeon at the cradle, and then there'll be like an assistant, like second in command, who'll be with the patient. Yes, so they do have kind of setups to, you know, safeguards for those kind of things. Yeah.
And if it goes wrong, do they abandon the technology? And
it is possible, yes. So it is possible that they can remove the robotic arms and then take over manually as well.
So, without thinking too hard, there's ethical questions galore in that.
Mm. Yes.
Is that the sort of thing that led you to the work you're doing now?
Yes, kind of. So after I finished working at King's, I moved over to Oxford to the Human-Centered Computing Group in the Department of Computer Science. And that's a group that brings together computer scientists and social scientists. And we work on projects that explore the impact of innovation. So how do computer-based innovations affect people's lives? How do they shape people's lives? And how does the way that we live shape innovation? And we're very interested in identifying ways to make sure that the design and development of technology is sensitive to people's needs, to societal needs, and that it's ethical as well. So innovation is not just done for its own sake or because it can make money and so on, but that there are good reasons for producing these kind of innovations and that they do bring a benefit to society. So a lot of the work that I'd done previously had that kind of strand in it, in understanding that there are ethical concerns around particular technologies and that they can have very positive impacts, but that also people can be fearful of technology or can have a feeling that it's not something that provides benefit to society. So the work that I've been doing at Oxford over the last 4.5 years really explores those kind of issues.
And you've worked on, I've got it written down here, about four, yes. So quite different, well, not quite different projects, but widely ranging projects. Mm. But there is a golden thread in there, I think.
Yes. So I have worked on a range of projects, and that's one of the great things about being a researcher is that you kind of get to do different kinds of things. So the first project I worked on at Oxford was about social media and continuing my interest in interaction. It was looking at how people interact with each other on social media, because I think all of us have an awareness that people will say things on social media that they don't say face-to-face, and that interactions can become inflammatory quite quickly, and this can lead to the spread of hate speech and so on. So I did a project that was looking at that.
And that's then, becoming to the fore at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, it really is. And I think it's quite interesting that the changes that are taking place, because that project was called Digital Wildfire, and that ran from 2014 to 2016. And at the time we did the project, I think we had a feeling that people were beginning to come aware that things such as the spread of hate speech, fake news and so on social media was problematic, but the social media platforms themselves had very little incentive to change it. Whereas since the end of that project, we've seen scandals such as, Cambridge Analytica and talk about fake news and how the setup of platforms can help to spread the fake news. And we see a lot more commentary from people in the public eye about the kind of inflammatory content they receive, concerns over bullying on social media. And I think we're seeing a lot more pressure coming onto the platforms that they just can't stand back and say, oh, it's up to users to, behave themselves. And a lot more awareness from the platforms that there are things that they could be doing themselves to, ban bad users or promote civility on social media. So I think we're seeing an interesting kind of change in the times at the moment, and hopefully more opportunities for positive change.
I was going to say, did we see it coming? But clearly we did, because you did a research project on it. Mm. Did we see it coming, the extent?
I think I sometimes wonder if, so the work they do at the moment often brings in the field of responsible innovation, and that emphasises sort of at the early stages of development to anticipate the consequences an innovation might have. And it's an interesting one, because I've spoken to people about social media and say, well, Mark Zuckerberg, when he set up Facebook, he didn't anticipate that it was going to become this big thing that it is, or that there would only be sort of like five major social media platforms that people use. So people kind of didn't predict it. But then actually maybe if, as a starting point, people had thought a bit harder about, what is it that we're setting up when we're allowing people to communicate instantaneously with multiple others all over the world, and they don't have kind of the immediate You know, they have the opportunity to be blinded when they say it, in the sense that, you know, people don't know that they're saying it and they can say things anonymously. Actually, I think we possibly could have anticipated that whilst that has many positives to it in terms of fostering freedom of speech and allowing important truths to be spoken, it can actually also create a situation in which people can say things that are very inflammatory, that are harmful, without any immediate censure, and that can have extremely negative consequences as well.
But we couldn't have expected Mark Zuckerberg to think through all of that.
No.
In his dorm.
Absolutely, yes. So we couldn't have expected him to anticipate it himself. But if there had been, and this is something, again, that responsible innovation emphasises, is sort of bringing in different stakeholder perspectives. And if at some stage early on, you know, the kind of technologists had spoken to, you know, people who specialise in communication or people who have concerns about bullying and so on and so on, if we'd had like a larger number of stakeholders in that conversation, actually perhaps people would have been able to say, well, you know, we have to think that it's a possibility that this thing might happen, or, you know, we have to understand that rumour can spread very, very quickly, and actually the internet is a fantastic place for rumour to spread, and this can have consequences for how people act and how they behave. And if perhaps if we'd had, you know, if we had more people in that conversation, then we could have started thinking a little bit earlier about what can we do to address it? Are there any things that we can do to prevent it? Because the problem that we have now is everyone's kind of used to social media platforms being the way they are. And to kind of pull that back and change it, you know, people have a very big kickback to that. Whereas if you set things up from the beginning and say, well, this is the way that it is, and this is like an etiquette or expectations or a policy around how we're going to use these platforms, then it becomes normalised much more quickly.
Are we expecting too much of those social media platforms? Are we expecting them to fix society's problems?
Possibly. And I think it, you know, with these kind of questions, you know, a lot of it does come down to, you know, the spread of, you know, fake news is not limited to the internet, it's not limited to social media platforms. Rumour has always spread. And, you know, the bullying is not limited to online either. So these are kind of human things that happen. So we shouldn't be expecting the social media platforms to fix society. But at the same time, they're a very large part of society too. So they shouldn't necessarily see themselves as external to it. You know, they don't just get to say, well, you know, it's a societal issue. It's not the technology itself. We have to think about how those two things interact.
Who was it that wrote The Geek Heresy? I can't remember. But I have talked to him.
Mm.
But his summary is that the technology at its best, or technology amplifies human pressures or something.
Yes.
Just throwing technology at it's not going to fix the problem.
Yes, that's very, very true. Absolutely. It has to be sort of technology, you know, embedded in understanding of society and how people operate and so on. But it's also very true that I think the internet is a great example of how technology does amplify things that we see elsewhere. Because, you know, with the spread of communications, you know, I can spread a rumour verbally, but I can spread it to, you know, maybe like 20 people in an hour. Whereas if I post it online, then it can go across the world in 10 minutes. So you do see like a big increase in scale.
Probably not as likely as a funny cat video is.
No, that's true. I would be behind the funny cat video.
We wouldn't have predicted Trump.
Well, yeah, I think a lot more. I think we're still in the days of, trying to understand what happened with that, I guess. And, you know, it's very interesting to see evidence that's coming out about how they used Facebook, for instance, with the Trump campaign and so on, and how personalised the advertising was in that instance, and how they really tailored it, you know, to the extent of changing the font that a particular Facebook user would use based on kind of a profile of them. And, you know, one of the big things on the Facebook adverts that the Trump campaign sent out was, you know, they knew that for certain reasons, like women might be unlikely to vote for Trump after certain things came out about him. So Trump campaign adverts wouldn't mention Trump himself. They'd talk about, you know, daycare policies and family-friendly policies and so on. So I think, you know, maybe tracing back, we can see how there were various affordances set up on social media or various ways in which people were using social media that could help us to see how that could be harnessed in political campaigning and mean that certain things would come about. But I think we're still in the early days of figuring out what happened
in
an election campaign.
Do you think social media is net positive?
Ultimately, yes, I would say. I mean, I think it has, and we have to be very cautious, you know, in the projects that we do, because we focus a lot on the negative side of things. And we do a lot of stuff, we do a lot of outreach work, in particular talking to young people about social media, and we don't want to be saying to them, keep off the internet, it's bad, because it's a wonderful resource. You know, it has all of this information available, networks, an opportunity to communicate, opportunity for activism, and so on. So it has all these many, many positives. It just has these negative sides as well. But yes, ultimately, I would agree, and I'd say it's a net positive.
Just in terms of that, we're talking about responsible innovation and that then be able to anticipate. If we describe what we're seeing in social media as mass personalisation, if we were to have sat down and said we can work out that you're going to get delivered what you want, and it's going to be tailored for the stuff that you're actually interested in, we'd have to have worked pretty hard to come up with negatives for that.
Negatives to the personalisation? I guess so. And this is... So I was worked on another project called Unbias, which looked at algorithm-driven online platforms. So we looked a lot at personalization mechanisms. And this was something that we talked to people about a lot. And people are quite divided about it.
So what does algorithmic mean?
So basically, we were looking at algorithms, are, you know, different kind of processes that filter the content that you see when you're browsing online. And one of the biggest ways that people notice the effects of algorithms when they're browsing is the kind of personalization that they see. So, you know, you'll be on Amazon and you'll buy something and it gives you suggestions for other things that you want to buy, because it's kind of like picked up your purchasing history, other, you know, other bits of information from your profile. Similarly with Facebook, it shows you content based on what you've liked in the past, and what kind of things the platform has calculated that you might be interested in. And increasingly, you know, we're seeing lots and lots of personalization occurring online. And this can be a very, very positive thing, because it can lead you to content that's very relevant to you. And also there's so much content online that you can't possibly work through it all yourself. So it can be extremely time-saving as well. There are many positive sides to it. And of course, advertisers like it because, you know, it can show you content that you're then going to buy. And this in turn means that you can browse online for free as well. So it, you know, it has positive effects for you. Where we get into the kind of negative side of things might be that for some people that they feel this is an invasion of privacy, because in order to be able to personalize this content to you, the platforms are collecting up a lot of information about you. And it can be quite, you know, interesting to see sort of, you know, how much information they're collecting about you and the kind of conclusions that they're drawing about you as well. Sometimes the personalization you receive can just be irrelevant. It can be wrong. You know, people often say, well, I've been on Amazon and I've just bought a lawnmower and now I'm being advertised more lawnmowers. Like, well, that's ridiculous because I don't need another one. And it can just be annoying in that sense. Sometimes it can be a bit invasive. So women often talk about, you know, maybe they've posted something on Facebook because they're just about to get married and so on, and then they start getting lots of advertisements for, like, pregnancy testing kits and stuff like that, because assumptions are being made about, you know, this is what you're going to do, this is what's going to happen, and that can be, you know, annoying or even offensive to people, the conclusions that are being made. When we did some of our field work, we went into schools. We went to a school in the centre of London, which had a very high number of students from Muslim backgrounds. In this country, we have something called the Prevent Programme, which is designed to stop people getting into terrorist activities. And this young woman was talking to us about YouTube and the adverts that she gets shown when she's on YouTube. And she sees lots of adverts about how not to be a terrorist. And she was a 14-year-old Muslim girl. And, you know, that you know, that the platform had picked up that she was Muslim and therefore she kind of, you know, needed to get these kind of like anti-terror adverts, and we were all, and that was just part of her standard existence, and she hadn't sort of realized that was anything unusual, whereas we're all quite taken aback. And you know, I think that kind of personalization, you're breaching onto areas where you're stereotyping people and you're making really quite negative assumptions,
and about have a negative effect.
Yeah, absolutely. You kind of see this content, you think, well, I should be seeing this, like who's showing me this content? I'm gonna,
they think that they think I might do this. Well,
exactly.
Maybe I will.
Exactly. I, you know, I really can see how it might have that effect, because, you know, you're being treated as, you know, a threat to your own society that you live in. And you can see how that might, you know, change people's perception of the world in which they're living in, and being treated as an outsider in that way.
Was working with schools a significant part of that project?
Yeah, so for both the Unbiased Project and the Digital Wildfire Project, we've had quite a lot of focus on young people, because they are digital natives. You know, they grow up online, and in many ways they have to be online. You know, sometimes when people talk about social media and they say, well, if you don't like it, don't go on it. But actually, I think if you're young now, you have no choice. You have to be online. You know, students in this country, they get set homework that requires them to be online. To communicate with other people, they need to have these social platforms and so on. So they're a very important population to consider. They're also very vulnerable online as well, because they don't necessarily have the digital maturity and resilience that are needed to navigate the online world. One reason is because most of the platforms are set up with adults in mind. So we know that lots of young people use Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and so on. But the terms and conditions, for instance, the way they're written, that's for an adult reader. You know, most people don't even read them. But, you know, if you read the content of them, that's set up for adults. It's not written in a way for young people to understand. And it can be difficult for young people to, you know, to truly understand the pros and cons of the platforms that they're using, and in particular to see the long-term consequences of it as well. You know, they might sort of post something immediately that seemed like good fun and so on, but like a week later or a few months later, it seems, you know, it's less fun, it can cause difficulties and so on. So we think of young people as being a particularly vulnerable population online, so one that we'd particularly like to reach with certain messages about how to understand, you know, the way platforms work, how to think about what you're posting online, what to think about when you're browsing and so on.
So the code itself doesn't have written into it, get everybody to be a terrorist.
Yep.
So at that pure level, you would argue that the code doesn't have values in it. Although perhaps by not taking it into account, then it's got an implicit value.
Yeah.
But it's the way that it operates at in the mass that brings on the values.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and one you see a lot of viewpoints about, because some people say, well, humans create the code and humans have values, and that's not a bad thing. You know, we all have values that drive the way that we work, the way that we think and so on. And it's inevitable that sometimes the values will be embedded into code. Sometimes even, you know, the choice to make that code or the particular way that it is, and that's inevitable that the values will be in there. And certainly sometimes you can see outcomes of it as well, you know, things that are completely unintended but can have often negative consequences in the way that maybe different demographics are treated and so on.
Given that the code doesn't have the values, whether they're right or wrong, it makes it hard to take them out if they're not there in the first place. It's not an easy fix if it's not something we can just, we'll just take that line out.
Yes, it's definitely not an easy fix, and it's something that I know is within the community. You know, there's a lot of discussion about it, a lot of debate around it, and a lot of, you know, some people say, well, it's code, it's pure, it is what it is, and it shouldn't be changed. Where other people say, well, actually, you know, even if you accept that the code has no values in and of itself, if it's having unintended but negative outcomes, then it's necessary to go back and change it. But then the question of how you go back and change it is, of course, extremely difficult as well.
So that's why it becomes a question of education and engagement.
I think, you know, education and engagement is a strong part of it as well. You know, very important that people are aware of these kind of issues and feel that they can make their own decisions about it as well. And it's kind of one of the, in many senses, the easiest changes to make, or certainly as a researcher, you know, it's a population that you can reach very easily. I always feel very wary of seeming as if we're putting like all of the responsibility onto the user to be educated about it, because actually I think that, you know, there's a role for policy as well, and a role for, you know, codes of practice amongst developers, for instance, you know, best practice guidelines, and they should take some responsibility for investigating these things too.
It's also a challenge for the companies themselves, because to some way they can't fix it, because we are the product.
Yes.
So they can hardly say, okay, we're not going to sell your data.
Yes.
Because that's what they do.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's a very, very complex issue, which one of the reasons that makes it so fascinating and unravelling it all, you know, there is no straightforward solution to it. And you can certainly understand, you know, these companies work on an economic imperative. So, you know, they go where the money goes. Which is why I think, you know, one of the most promising opportunities for positive change, I suppose, is if there is kind of like a consumer-led pressure on companies to have better practice. You know, if people saying, well, you know, we'll use your service if they're responsible services, if you handle data in a responsible way, if you personalise our content in a responsible way, but we won't use it if you use it in other ways. And I think that can, perhaps we're beginning to see that kind of pressure can exert an influence.
And we're going to post on Twitter that Twitter is bad.
Yes, we're going to tweet about how bad Twitter is.
You did some work in Africa.
Yes, I worked on a project that was run in our computer science department at Oxford, and also in a department called INSIS, which is part of the School of Anthropology in Oxford. And we had some money from a Global Challenges Research Fund grant, which is set up for work that does capacity building in some way. And we ran a project. We had a model for a kind of event that can address resource scarcity. So our starting point was the understanding that in countries in Southern Africa, for instance, universities and schools have a severe shortage of laboratory equipment. So even sort of very straightforward pieces of equipment, such as magnetic stirrers, PCR machines and so on, they don't have many of them. And this creates problems for STEM education. So if you could imagine, you know, you're a student at university, and maybe there's only one centrifuge between about 60 of you. So you don't have many opportunities to learn hands-on how to use the equipment. You don't have chances to experiment with it yourselves. The problem being that, you know, these pieces of equipment are extremely expensive to buy because they're imported, and, you know, so people are relying on kind of old and outdated piece of equipment. So my colleagues and I were talking about this problem and also talking about the fact that through the open hardware and the open science movement, there are actually lots of kind of plans publicly available, like documentation that can help people to build their own pieces of equipment. And in computer science, we often have events called hackathons, which are kind of competitions where you get groups of students together and you set them a challenge and they have to design something. So we were talking and we said, well, what if we had like a design competition where people had to build their own pieces of laboratory equipment, and they could use resources that are available through the open science movement to help them to design these things. So that's what we decided we wanted to do. And we had a pilot lab hackathon in Zimbabwe last year. So we had groups of undergraduate students from mixed disciplines. We had computer scientists, engineers, economists, people from, you know, business schools and so on, and they formed together in groups, and they each undertook a challenge, and they had to build design and build their own piece of laboratory equipment. So they did a lot of the work beforehand, and then they came to our event, which we ran in Harare at the Harare Institute of Technology. So they all came together for a weekend, and they gave talks about what they'd build and the challenges that they'd face while they built it, and they gave demonstrations of their pieces of equipment. And they made really fantastic bits of equipment. So they made magnetic stirrers, centrifuges, PCR machines, and then we had an open competition as well, so people could, you know, design whatever they felt that they needed. And the aim of the event was to see, like, is it possible for people to build their own working prototypes of equipment, and can we challenge them to do it in a way that's frugal, so their designs don't cost very much money, and that they can create good documentation that can then be passed on to other people, so then other people can look at the documentation and they can build their own pieces of equipment. And we had some really fantastic results. We have a website called labhack.net, and you can take a look and see some of the results of it as well. So our winning design, someone made a centrifuge, and they made it out of cardboard, and it cost less than $100 to make. Whereas if you buy a centrifuge in Zimbabwe, it costs you thousands of dollars. So you can really see, you know, the difference in that. And it's a working centrifuge. We have a video of it on our website. You know, it would need calibrating to match industrial standards, but it works. So, you know, it shows that this is like a working thing that can be done. And we have another team who entered the open call of the competition, and they made a bioreactor, and they decided to make a bioreactor because the bioreactor at their university had broken, so they wanted to replace it. So they came and they built a bioreactor. They took it back to the university and they gave the plans for their build to their faculty as well. And we had an email recently from the faculty leader who said, you know, this team has allowed other teams to look at their documentation, so now other people in the university are making bioreactors and we're using them in the courses that we're teaching. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly kind of the aim of the model, that this would become a sustainable thing, because, you know, people would make their builds and they'd make their documentation available, and so that other people would be able to use the same documentation and keep building as well. So it was a really fun event to be involved in, and it's a model that we're very passionate about as well, that hopefully it can, you know, we want sort of people all over Southern Africa to be able to run their own lab hack competitions and kind of create these networks where people are building things and making their documentation available for other people to use as well.
And you've also worked on ethical hackathons.
Yes, that's right. So hackathons are people in the computer sciences and often engineering. Hackathon competitions are very well known, and they're a lot of fun as well. So usually students come together and they're set some kind of challenge. So they have to, like, build a, you know, whatever. And they normally work over the course of a weekend, often like without any sleep. Lots of pizza and no sleep are the features of a hackathon. And what happens is they kind of get together and they're coding stuff up, and things are judged on kind of the quality of the technical design. What we do in the ethical hackathons is a little bit different, because it's more emphasizing how you can think about ethics and responsibility all the way through the design process. So it's less about coding and more about getting people to think about, well, this is a design challenge, and you have to imagine that you're making a something. How are you going to make sure that it's, you know, kind to users? How are you going to make sure it's sort of using resources in a very positive way, and so on? So what we do in an ethical hackathon is we try to bring together people from different disciplines. So you have computer scientists working with, you know, social scientists and lawyers and so on and so on. And we set them a challenge. So for instance, we've run it a couple of times, and we've had some sessions at the start of the event where we talk to people about online platforms and some of the issues that we've discussed here about, you know, excessive personalization, some of the controversies around bias and algorithms and so on. And then we say to them, well, we want you to imagine that you're setting up a new social network, and your social network is committed to the responsible use of algorithms. Tell us what that network is going to look like. And then they have to go away and think about it, and they have to talk about, well, you know, how are we going to make money? You know, so are we going to advertise? Are we going to have subscriptions and so on? And how much data are we going to collect about people? And all of those kind of issues. So they don't necessarily have to code anything up, but they have to come back to us with, you know, like a mock-up or like a business plan of what the network is going to look like, and talk through these kind of issues and show us that they're aware of all the ethical concerns around these things. So it's not just a technical innovation, but it's a responsible one as well. So it's sort of like thinking about, you know, building something for societal good. And as with hackathons, you know, these are competitions, so people work in teams, and they give presentations of, you know, their designs on their ideas, and there are winners, and they're good fun, you know, good fun things to run. You know, students enjoy them, and in particular we try to emphasize that the students should be learning from each other. So, you know, someone from the social sciences can, you know, help people from more technical backgrounds to understand some of the ethical issues that they've been studying, and people from the more technical backgrounds can say to them, well this is great, but that would never work, you know, as a model, and so on. So it's a lot about kind of peer learning as well. So it's like an educational kind of event as
now,
well.
Now, we teach people how to do research ethics. Do we teach them societal ethics?
Yeah, I think this is something that sort of we are doing increasingly so, but we will benefit from doing more of, you know. And I think it can vary according to, you know, university to university and course to course. But there's been, certainly for me, you know, obviously from a social science background, but I now work in computer science, and I meet many people who, you know, they're just focused on, you know, the computing side of things, and they don't necessarily see it as a computing issue about the social impacts of things or the ethical impact of things.
It's pretty easy to get there as soon as you start talking about self-driving cars. It's direct link to the trolley problem.
Absolutely. And there are so many, and that's the thing, you know, I think we're realizing more and more, you know, in the public eye and beyond, that actually these things are really bound up in ethical issues. And certainly the students that I talk to are really interested in them as well. So I think we're at a place where we can really foster, you know, when students are studying, like foster this understanding that, you know, you're building these systems and actually ethics is like an embedded part of them. I think it used to be in the past that, you know, ethics was often seen as kind of like an engineering problem, or it's something you thought about at the end, whereas actually we're beginning to understand that it's something you think about all the way through the process. So it's like right from the beginning stage, you think about values, what values are going into this design, or you're thinking about, you know, development, like who do we need to talk to ensure that we're thinking about the consequences of this design. Think about implementation and how can we anticipate the impacts this might have. So it's becoming increasingly apparent that, you know, these are ethical issues like driverless cars and so on. And I think we're increasingly seeing a response to that on the educational level as well, that students are being encouraged to think about these kind of issues.
And from a sustainability perspective, because one of my arguments is that sustainability is ethics extended in space and time. So if you say, okay, the trolley problem, and then we're going to multiply that by intergenerational equity.
Right.
Let's see where that takes us in terms of our in terms of our thinking.
Yes.
I particularly like the black box
concept
that you've been working on.
Yeah, so this is a project that I'm working on at the moment, and it is led by my boss, Marina Drotka, who is Professor of Human-Centered Computing at Oxford, and it's in collaboration with Bristol Robotics Lab, in particular Alan Winfield, who is a Professor of Robot Ethics. And the starting point for the project, so the project is all about social robots. So this is robots that, you know, interact with humans in some way. So driverless cars, robots in care homes, robot toys, and so on. And the starting point for the project is the understanding that people are often quite wary of social robots, or that, you know, the idea of social robots being in our lives. And, you know, I think it varies from country to country, but certainly in the UK and across Europe, people are very, very worried about social robots. And one of the things that they worry about is that they're not safe, and that they're not necessarily governed properly. So they worry that an accident might happen. And in particular, you know, we see reports about driverless cars, for instance, accidents happening with driverless cars. And people don't necessarily trust that those accidents will be investigated properly, that the companies who are running the trials for the driverless cars will, you know, have oversight, you know, or oversight will be done over them to ensure these accidents don't happen again. So as part of a kind of responsible innovation agenda, you often do anticipatory work, kind of, you know, and thinking through the consequences of these kind of innovations. So we understand that, you know, hopefully accidents will be very rare, but they are inevitable. You know, they're going to take place. So then we start looking at well, robotics isn't necessarily a trusted industry. Other industries that are more trusted. And the industry that Marina and Alan turned to the aviation industry. And comparatively, that's a very trusted industry. You know, plane crashes do happen, unfortunately, but people still fly. And people, you know, often understand that, well, it's a particular plane that had the problem. It's not all planes. And so they looked to it and thought, well, what can we learn from the aviation industry? What is it? What processes do they have that mean that people trust them? So at the heart of this is a black box flight recorder. So, you know, planes have these black boxes that mean when an incident occurs, it's collected up loads of data that's useful information to learn how to unpack what happened in a particular incident. And that black box forms, you know, the centre of an investigation process. And aviation also has a no-blame data sharing culture, in that when an accident happens, you know, different companies will share data with each other because the investigating what happened is more important than the kind of like keeping this information proprietary and so on. So we started thinking about that and saying, well, can we translate that into robots? So the idea for the project is RoboTips, and what we're going to be doing is creating a black box for robots. And we're calling it an ethical black box because it would be not ethical to not have a black box. So we're going to design and create these ethical black boxes and put them into social robots. And we're going to work alongside different partners from industry in the development of these black boxes and talk to different kind of stakeholders to help us understand, you know, what these black boxes should look like and how they should be used and so on. So we're going to put them into robots, and then we're going to, in a very safe and controlled way, we're going to create accidents with them as well. So we'll have a driverless car with an ethical black box, and in a very safe environment, it's going to go wrong. And so we'll take the data from that black box and we'll use it as part of a process of incident and accident investigation. And we'll include human witnesses in that process as well, and kind of have these mock investigations to trial out this process to see, you know, if we run these kind of investigations to find out, you know, Why did this driverless car turn left instead of right? Why did this happen in this particular instance? And have also alongside kind of human witness accounts and so on, can this become a form of governance, kind of like immediate response when an incident occurs? And can that become part of a process that helps people to feel a greater sense of trust in social robots? Because they will understand that, you know, a negative outcome will be acted on immediately and steps will be taken immediately to prevent it from happening again.
Very quickly, before we have some questions to end with, and this is all coming together in the Orbit.
Yes.
Is it Orbit RI?
So the website is Orbit RRI. Yes. So responsible innovation in Europe, it has a particular meaning because it's an initiative that came out of the EU. And now in the UK, our research funding councils have taken it on very strongly. So one of our research councils is the EPSRC, and they fund a lot of kind of technical projects that go on. And they say that all projects that they fund should have a responsible innovation or responsible research and innovation element to it. So Orbit is something that we in the Human Centred Computing Group at Oxford and also colleagues at De Montfort University in Leicester have set up, and it's a repository for responsible innovation in the ICT community. So it has resources available for researchers and people in industry who want to adopt responsible innovation approaches. So it's a source of information. The website has case studies of projects that have been run using responsible innovation initiatives. It has information about sort of frameworks that you can apply to different stages of development. It also has a research journal, and it runs workshops and courses. So at the minute, one of the things that we're going to be doing is going to different universities and running responsible innovation sessions for computer scientists and engineers there to sort of, you know, give them, you know, as we were talking about, this kind of like early training and understanding why these issues are important. And there are also services that Orbit provides for industry as well.
Okay, some questions to end with. Mm-hmm. Do you have a go-to definition of sustainability?
No.
That's okay. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
Oh, I would say sort of, you know, personally, you know, on a personal level, the work that we did in Zimbabwe was certainly the most satisfying. You know, it was an idea that we had that we wanted to test out, and then when we ran it, and just the success we had was so fantastic, seeing how enthusiastic people were there about it and the response we've had. You know, I still have emails from students telling us how they're continuing with this work. I have one a couple of days ago from a student who sent me like a bunch of pictures because they've still been continuing to work on what they're doing. So yeah, that one has been the most satisfying, I would say.
So we're writing a book of these conversations. It's called Tomorrow's Heroes.
Right.
You're in the mansion. What's your superpower? What got you there?
To be one of tomorrow's heroes. Oh. I should say something noble, shouldn't I? I can't just say invisibility.
No, I won't let you have that. All laser eyes.
I think... I suppose it's about communication. It's about reaching out to different groups and getting them to talk to each other. And importantly, getting people to talk in the same language. Because one of the things, you know, being a social scientist working amongst technical people, you realise that sometimes you're talking at cross purposes, and it's very, very important to get people to kind of have a baseline understanding of, you know, what is it that we're talking about and develop the same language. So my superpower would be communication.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
Yes and no. And I think it's, for me as a researcher, I still kind of stick to, you know, I want to do social good with the work that I do, but that's not necessarily the same thing as being an activist in the political sense. And as a researcher, it's often important to be open to be criticised in that sense, to be open to different viewpoints, and not kind of not shut myself off and not saying I'm doing it from this perspective, therefore, you know, I'm not open to other perspectives. So kind of in a research way, no, but in a personal way, yes.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
Opportunities to find out about very exciting things and to see into different kind of contexts that I don't normally have a chance to see. So in my work, I've been extremely lucky. I've worked in all kind of different settings and I've met hugely different people and seen different things at work. So that's fantastic. So getting a chance to get into those environments, to understand how they work, is very rewarding. And then sometimes you get the opportunity to help people who want to make things better as well.
Three more. What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
The biggest challenge, so for the next couple of years, I'm going to be working exclusively on this RoboTips project. So the most immediate challenge is going to be persuading our research ethics committee to let us set up accidents with robots, which is going to be quite interesting to do, and then setting them up as well. I think, you know, obviously we need to make sure that they're controlled and safe, but we want them to be kind of naturalistic as well. So working out how we can balance those things, I think, is going to be a fun intellectual challenge and a very rewarding one, because I think at the end of it we're going to produce some very interesting findings as well.
If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur, well, what would you have happen?
Oh my goodness. I suppose it would be to have a lot more money available for research, because we have so many things that we could do and we'd like to do, but we often lack the resources for it.
And lastly, do you have any advice for our listeners?
Oh, good heavens. I would say go with what you're interested in and don't do what you think you should do. So going back to what I was talking at the beginning, don't become a lawyer just because you think you should be. Go with what interests you and be ready to go with the flow as well, because my career has worked out very, very differently, you know, and I've had a few kind of slight changes of direction, and it's been brilliant, actually. It's been really great. So be prepared to go with the flow.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you very much indeed.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. Each week we talk with somebody making a positive difference and try to see the world through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Dr. Helena Webb from the Department of Computer Science at the University of Oxford. We've been talking about, how do we summarise it, responsible innovation. That'll do, because there's lots of things in there. You can find Sustainable Lens on iTunes and all the other poddy sorts of places, and there is an archive of our podcasts on sustainablelens.org. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.
At Otago Polytechnic, we've made a commitment to sustainability in all that we do. High quality, hands-on education is our trademark, and it's delivered with a focus on sustainable practice. We even have a school dedicated to it, our Centre for Sustainable Practice. For more information, check out our website, otagopolytechnic.ac.nz. A bright future is a sustainable future. Otago Polytechnic, proud sponsor of Sustainable Lens.
Take ORFM Dunedin with you wherever you go with podcasts and live streaming of Primo local content. Download the Access Internet Radio app for free from Google Play and the Apple App Store.
This program was first broadcast on ORFM Dunedin and made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.